Welcome to the Deep Dive. We sift through the noise, you know, try to bring you the most vital, thought-provoking insights. Today, we're plunging into a topic that, well, it touches every single one of us. Education systems. All around the globe, it's complex, often pretty contentious, our mission to unpack a whole stack of compelling sources. We've got everything from really harrowing accounts of academic pressure to, you know, philosophical critiques of modern schooling, and we want to explore what a truly effective, maybe even humane, education might actually look like.
Yeah, and this deep dive couldn't be more crucial, really, because education, it's not just about what's taught. It's really about how and why it matters, the profound impact it has on individuals, on society as a whole. And as we'll get into some of the very foundations of how we do education now, well, they have surprisingly recent and frankly kind of startling origins.
Okay, let's start with something pretty stark. A reality check that, honestly, demands our attention. Our sources highlight stories that are almost unbelievable, but tragically common. Like, imagine a high school girl in Asia, found dead, leaving a note saying, "I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, I couldn't fulfill your dreams." Her life ended over a single bad exam score. I mean, what does that tell us about a system that could lead there?
It's devastating. And these aren't just, you know, isolated tragedies. They expose a brutal truth, the truth about how many educational models worldwide are really designed for conformity, for intense competition, not human flourishing. The statistics are just chilling. One third of students in South Korea, they've contemplated self-harm because of academic pressure. In Japan, self-inflicted death is actually the leading cause of death for children. And in China, it's so dire, some schools have even installed metal bars on windows to stop students from jumping.
Wow, the scale of that? It's truly staggering. How do you even begin to shift pressures that are so deeply ingrained in society? A huge part of this pressure cooker, it seems, comes down to these high-stakes national entrance exams. We're talking about China's Gaokao, Japan's Common Test, India's JEE, South Korea's Suning. These aren't just tests, are they? A low score on one exam can literally dictate a student's whole future, deciding access to good universities, jobs, even like their social standing.
Absolutely. And for these students, daily life. Well, one source compared it to modern slavery. Mm-hmm. Picture this grueling 16-hour study schedule, pretty common in South Korea. Wake up 6:30 a.m., school 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., then straight to cram school till 9 p.m. After that, self-study at the school library until 11 p.m., and then home study until 2 a.m. That was just 4 hours for sleep before it all starts again.
Just 4 hours. And what's really striking isn't just the schedule, it's the why. For these kids, this isn't some extreme optional choice they're making. This intense study, it's a societal necessity, driven by these overwhelming expectations and the, you know, direct link between getting into university and their future economic security. What kind of childhood is even possible under those conditions?
Right. And adding to that burden is what one source calls a deeply toxic culture around competition.
Yeah.
Think about it. All grades, all test scores publicly displayed for parents, for other students to see. So for those with low scores, it leads to immense shame, insecurity, even bullying. It just creates this relentless cycle of pressure. Study harder, harder, harder. Failure is public humiliation.
And as if that wasn't enough, there's physical abuse. Another horrifying factor in these high rates of self-inflicted deaths. One account, it describes seeing a six-year-old in China getting smacked with a wooden stick by a teacher for a wrong math answer. It's shocking that even though it's illegal in many places, it still happens. And some parents apparently even prefer it. What does that say about the mindset? Or maybe a misunderstanding of what actually motivates kids?
It's incredibly widespread, unfortunately. Back in 2011, stats showed 70% of junior high students in Taiwan experienced physical abuse from teachers. And 98% of South Korean students reported physical punishment from teachers that same year. 98%. And there have been multiple self-inflicted deaths directly linked to physical punishment. It just points to this profound breakdown of trust, doesn't it? An emphasis on control, not real education.
Compounding all this, there's this profound cultural taboo around mental health in Asia. Our sources describe it like talking about your diarrhea. You just don't discuss it openly. It's seen as a sign of weakness, selfishness even. What are the costs of denying those inner struggles?
Well, the consequences are severe. Students hide their struggles, they rarely seek help. Mental illnesses often go undiagnosed, or they're just denied outright. They suffer in silence. And get this, a striking 70% of South Korean students who ended their lives showed no unusual characteristics beforehand. This is made worse by bullying, abuse from parents, and alarmingly, an increase in self-inflicted deaths among really young kids. We're talking 5 to 14-year-olds in China, 10 to 14 in South Korea. driven by that early academic pressure for school entrance exams, the whole system is so focused on external stuff, the metrics, that it just becomes blind to this deep internal distress.
Okay, so it's clear this global pressure cooker, it isn't an accident, it's systemic. Our sources suggest many of our modern education systems are, well, as one put it, stuck in the past, outdated. So how did we get here? What was the original blueprint that kind of created these conditions?
Exactly. It goes back really to the Prussian education model.
Yeah.
Early 1800s.
Yeah.
And it wasn't designed to foster independent thought or, you know, critical citizens. Not at all. It was explicitly designed to meet the needs of the state by preparing docile, obedient individuals for factory work. So it prioritized memorization, conformity, obedience. And this model, because it seemed efficient, I guess, was widely adopted globally, including much of the West. So yeah, we're essentially running a 19th century factory model in a 21st century world.
A factory model. And that industrial mindset led to this sort of assembly line approach to learning, right? Kids grouped strictly by age into grades, learning specific concepts in a set order, like products on a conveyor belt. What does that kind of standardization do to, you know, individual learning styles? Or just innate curiosity?
Well, it squashes them often. This industrial legacy is precisely why, as Sir Ken Robinson famously argued, he said, creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. It just highlights this fundamental misalignment we've got.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how kids are naturally unafraid to be wrong. They see it as learning. One source shared that story about Frank, the kid who said, I like to be wrong because if you're wrong, you get to explore something new. Love that. Yet the system, by stigmatizing mistakes, by promoting this idea that you have to cling to success, it basically educates people out of their creative capacities. Picasso said it, right? All children are born artists. The problem is to remain an artist as we grow up. So how does this institutional fear of failure then create this rigid hierarchy of subjects?
Yeah, that suppression of creativity, it's reinforced by this like universal hierarchy of subjects you find everywhere. Maths and languages.
Yeah.
Always at the top. Then humanities and way down at the bottom, the arts. Art, music, drama, dance. And this all stems from a deeply flawed belief about which subjects are most useful for work. And really narrow academic-focused definition of intelligence. It tells kids that their urge to dance or draw is somehow less valuable than, you know, memorizing facts.
And the result is what people are calling academic inflation. Degrees become less valuable because everyone has one. Yet so many talented, brilliant, creative people think they're not smart, because their unique strengths were undervalued or even stigmatized by the very system meant to educate them. It's kind of a self-defeating cycle, isn't it?
Totally. And it connects directly to the critical thinking gap. The historical design of this modern education system, it inherently makes students conform, obey, rather than, you know, question assumptions, evaluate evidence, analyze things from multiple perspectives. The system often doesn't teach critical thinking explicitly. It's almost designed against it by rewarding compliance.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Look at American higher education, because our sources raise some pretty serious concerns there too, that universities might not be serving students well either, continuing this sort of problematic blueprint.
Yeah, you know, one glaring issue is just the massive student debt. It's huge. An average undergraduate degree can cost around $30,000 a year, per year. And many argue it's for what's increasingly a lower quality education. The value proposition, it's just not what it used to be for a lot of people.
Right. And it seems like many universities are now marketing an experience, that's the word they use, selling luxurious gyms, fancy dining halls, events, activities, which drives up tuition. And critics argue it diverts money away from the core mission, teaching and research. I saw one stat, like at Harvard, there are over 3 administrators for every 1 faculty member, and many are focused on student life. What does that say about their real priorities?
Well, it's a direct impact on the quality of education, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Students often end up in these huge lecture classes, hundreds of students, personal feedback from a professor, almost impossible. And a lot of the actual direct teaching comes from graduate students or underpaid adjuncts, people who lack institutional support, stability. It feels like a system that prioritizes amenities over actual instruction sometimes.
And then there's this concerning trend. Universities pushing to make classes easier, less demanding, which naturally lowers student expectations. In the humanities, for instance, sources say students struggle to read whole books now, or long articles, because their high school education, so focused on standardized tests, conditioned them to only read little excerpts, snippets. I mean, what kind of intellectual rigor are we fostering if the bar keeps getting lowered?
It's led to this critique that the system effectively rips students off.
Mm.
The argument goes that you can often get more effective personal impact through like alternative platforms, online discussions, self-study, places that might actually convince people they can read philosophy or tough books, unlike the traditional university setting, which sometimes, maybe inadvertently, discourages it.
Okay, switching back to K-12 in the U.S. Common Core. Introduced back in 2009, it was this ambitious, what was it, $15.8 billion initiative to revolutionize education. Was it an attempt to fix some of this stuff, or did it just kind of reinforce the old blueprint?
Well, its goals sounded pretty good on paper. Raise standards, better prepare students for college and work, define specific knowledge benchmarks, you know, like when kids should know algebra or calculus, and shift teaching to focus more on critical thinking, applying knowledge to real-world documents.
Yeah.
They use the Hamilton papers as an example instead of just rote memorization. Sounds good, right? But the implementation, that was the tricky part.
Yeah, and there was initial broad support, wasn't there? Mostly driven by this fear that the U.S. was lagging behind other OECD countries academically. We were below average in math in 2009, apparently, plus a desire for uniform standards across states. For comparison, the Obama administration incentivized it too, with those Race to the Top grants. So it seemed like everyone was on board at first.
But it quickly took a turn. There's widespread confusion, parental ridicule even, over new homework methods. You know, parents famously saying, look, I'm just going to show you long division the way I know it.
Mm.
And ultimately, the results were disappointing. Federally funded research a decade later showed only tiny negative effects to tiny positive effects and a lot of neutral effects on student achievement. So basically a very costly experiment with negligible impact.
And the main theories for why it failed, they seem to point to it's taking control away from teachers, the ones who actually know their students best. This idea that kids are not cogs in a machine, they don't all learn at the same pace, that got lost. It also failed to really account for the financial difficulties, the poverty faced by millions of kids in the U.S., like 10.5 million children.
Yeah.
So, yeah, trying to standardize human beings, it fell flat.
Right. So today, Common Core has largely fallen out of favor. Many states have withdrawn or just relabeled their standards. Often that was due to politics more than effectiveness, to be honest. But some elements do persist in various forms. Its failure, though, it really reminds us that a top-down standardized approach, it often misses something fundamental about learning, which leads us to ask, okay, what truly makes someone educated today in a world that's constantly changing?
And this is where our sources get really interesting, I think, suggesting it's far more than just facts or test scores. We're searching for a better way forward now.
Exactly. When we talk about being educated in, say, 2025, it's not just about hoarding facts. It's more about a familiarity with how the world works, how people function. And fundamentally, it's about the interactions and relationships we have with other humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's about navigating the real world, not just textbooks.
Which is why that distinction between book smart and street smart is so important, right? Both are crucial. Our sources highlight this. Using the example of engineers who might be brilliant, super book smart, but they lack the street smarts to, say, read a room during a presentation. They know the tech stuff, but struggle with the human side. Is the system kind of blind to that type of intelligence?
Often, yes. And it's crucial to remember, intelligence is incredibly diverse. It's not just one thing. We think visually, in sound, kinesthetically, through movement, in abstract terms. And it's dynamic. The brain isn't neatly divided into compartments. Creativity, you know, having original ideas that have value often comes from the interaction between different ways of seeing things. Like, take Gillian Lynn, choreographed Cats, Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing career. As a kid in the 1930s, she was labeled with a learning disorder, couldn't concentrate, always fidgeting. But her doctor realized, wait, she's not sick. She's a dancer. Told her mom, take her to a dance school. That simple shift let her distinct intelligence flourish, turned a problem into extraordinary talent.
That's powerful. And it leads to this really profound idea. Kids aren't empty vessels. They're not just waiting for us to pour knowledge in. They're born with this innate ability to create, to question, to learn. So if that's true, what's our role as adults? What should we be doing?
Well, traditional schooling often does the opposite, doesn't it? It kind of silences kids, causes them to lose their natural curiosity, their keenness to learn, which is such a contrast to the idea that learning is fundamental. It's enjoyable for humans, something we want to do. It's like we're unteaching their innate joy.
Yeah, one source uses this great analogy of a gardener stretching stems. If you over-intervene, try to force a child's development, you can ultimately deform it, kill their natural growth. What kids truly need, it argues, is an environment that respects their inner needs, food, safety, and maybe most importantly, love. Does this imply our current systems fundamentally misunderstand how kids develop?
I think it does. Love is vital at all stages. Yet education too often relies on threats, punishment, tension, fear. And that kind of fear-based conditioning, it can cause a child to lose touch with their own will to live, essentially. They start performing for external rewards or just to avoid punishment, not for joy, not for fulfillment. It breaks that internal motivation and replaces it with anxiety.
Which brings us to a core principle that really stood out. Education without freedom results in a life of unfulfillment. The sources argue that kids must be free at school to truly learn and develop. But what does that actually look like in practice?
Well, it means fostering student choice in subjects, in activities, allowing them to follow their own impulses, respect their own timing, letting them discover their individual gifts. It moves away from forcing them to memorize stuff they don't care about, like, I don't know, actinium Ac-3 metal,
yeah,
just to get a grade. Imagine the difference in motivation when a child genuinely chooses what they learn.
Yeah, it's a huge shift from focusing on external goals, grades, prizes, diplomas, to internal motivation. The focus moves to the process of learning, the enjoyment you get from it, rather than just the final objective or the result. It's about changing the whole definition of success in education, really.
And it also means rethinking the teacher's role, radically, from being the star of the show, dictating lessons, to being more of a humble guide, an observer, a facilitator, someone who unveils knowledge rather than just imposing answers. It involves fostering dialogue, cooperation, trusting kids to become masters of their own life. The teacher becomes a partner in discovery, not a drill sergeant.
It reminds me of that story of the student who, when told they needed a degree to be somebody, just shot back, I already am somebody.
Yeah.
That's such a powerful statement of self-worth, something current systems often just crush.
Exactly. And furthermore, we need to challenge this practice of separating kids strictly by age. It assumes they all have the same interests, the same capabilities at the same time, which is just not true. This approach, it homogenizes children and can lead to misinterpreting individual differences as psychiatric conditions. Hence, this epidemic of hyperactivity diagnoses, the use of psychotropics on kids who are just diverse. We're medicalizing normal childhood variants.
Which really highlights the need for a more holistic education, right? It's something that goes beyond fragmented subjects, integrating areas so that, like the source says, maths are history and they are language and geography at the same time.
Yeah.
An approach that embraces art as a fundamental right for creativity, that cultivates emotional intelligence, self-knowledge. How does that kind of integration fight back against that industrial fragmentation we talked about?
And we absolutely cannot overlook the crucial role of the family in all this. Our sources argue parents are the primary protagonists of education, not schools, but many families seem to have lost confidence in their own instincts to raise children. They mistakenly believe it's some professional activity best outsourced to schools. They forget that for thousands of years, kids learned at home, from parents, community, observing, participating in life.
Which means we need to reemphasize the profound impact of just parental presence. Kids need to be with their parents. Being separated too early or for too long, you know, parents may be only seeing their child for an hour a day that can hinder development, cause real suffering, a kind of silent suffering from an unnatural separation.
Ultimately, as one source powerlessly puts it, the most revolutionary idea that exists is to try to make people happy.
Well, loving children.
Teaching them to love others. That's the foundation. From that, the source argues, knowledge will appear all by itself. It's a kind of radical simplicity, isn't it?
So looking ahead, even if we embrace these, well, pretty radical ideas, there are still huge practical challenges, like the ongoing struggle for teachers, particularly in the U.S. Our sources point to the significant wage gap. Mm. Teachers earning nearly 20% less than other professionals with similar education. And get this, 60% less than their counterparts in other OECD countries. 60%. Why is such a vital profession so consistently undervalued?
Well, there are historical roots. The American public school system as we know it was reconfigured about a century ago. It was framed as women's work, largely as a way to save taxpayer money. And that set this precedent for low pay, for diminished status. Teaching was seen as less complex than other professions. It created this long-term economic disadvantage that persists today.
And the consequences are stark, aren't they? Low teacher retention rates up to a quarter lead every year in some places. Widespread shortages. The fact that one-fifth of the teaching workforce has to have a second job just to make ends meet, it's no wonder you see movements like Red for Ed popping up. How can we expect a thriving education system if we don't support the people actually doing the work?
Right. Now let's talk about the elephant in the room. AI, artificial intelligence. Some people are provocatively saying things like, the education system is dead and AI just buried it.
Hmm.
Now, while it's true that rote memorization for basic facts is largely gone, AI gives instant answers, memorization itself still plays a really important role in developing intellectual ability, shaping the brain. It's about building context, cognitive connections, not just recalling isolated facts.
Which makes teaching AI literacy absolutely paramount, doesn't it? Starting really early, like elementary school, just like internet literacy became essential a couple decades ago. Future jobs are going to depend heavily on how well people can use these AI tools. So what are the new skills that become crucial in this landscape?
Well, there's potential for AI to actually enhance creativity, not kill it. By taking over the grunt work, the tedious stuff, it could free up humans to focus more on the creative aspects, the higher level thinking. However, it's really crucial to be cautious here. AI cannot fully replace the socialization, the networking, the nuanced critical thinking that happens through human interaction. You know, the stuff you get in traditional educational settings, ideally. It's a powerful tool, yes, but it's not a replacement for human connection and mentorship.
So across all our sources, there's this overarching call for a new educational paradigm, one that actively challenges what's been called the forbidden education, which is like the societal tendency to look the other way, to prioritize final goals over the learning process, to resist trying new things. It sounds like a call for pretty radical change, not just tinkering around the edges.
Exactly. And the truth is, there's no single magic recipe, no one best model for education. Mm. What's needed instead is true diversity. Many free, autonomous educational experiences that respect individual timing, individual motivation. The goals should shift, maybe from asking, what did you learn, to prioritizing, how did you feel? Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental shift from output to human experience.
And as we wrap up, maybe the most powerful thought is simply that the basic principle of all change is just questioning what we believe. Real progress requires all of us, educators, parents, society, to be willing to undergo an internal change, letting go of old beliefs, embracing a more compassionate, more holistic approach to learning and to life itself. It means challenging our deepest assumptions about what education even is. So after all that, what does this mean for you, our listener? What really stands out to you from this deep dive?
Yeah, maybe you remember that education at its best is about cultivating the whole being, head, heart, and hands, and allowing each individual to discover and fulfill their unique potential,
mm-hmm.
supported by love and by freedom. It's about nurturing that innate curiosity we all have inside us, not stamping it out.
Okay, so here's a final provocative thought for you to chew on. If our current education systems are mostly rooted in an industrial past, and if real learning stems from innate curiosity, from joy, from the freedom to explore, what's one tangible way you could start to maybe unschool your own approach to learning or support that kind of authentic discovery in the lives of the kids around you starting today? What would that look like?